OTB's Mount Rushmore. 32 counties. One county representative choosing their sporting Mount Rushmore. Some decisions are easy.
Number one cornerstone on this monument is Stephen Staunton. And I would wager that by the age of 21, he probably had a CV like on par with anything we've seen in Irish sport.
Others are controversial.
Michael Murphy might actually be debated as whether he deserved to be there any more than some of the players from 1992.
Join the debate across all our social channels at Off the Ball.
Galway is so diverse. I think Galway people can feel fairly proud of them too.
And catch the live decision making over the next few months on OTB AM, live every weekday at 7:30 AM on OTB Sports Radio. The OTB Podcast Network.
And you are welcome back to Off the Ball Saturday on News Talk. John Duggan with you through till 5 o'clock in the company of the Irish Independent football correspondent Daniel McDonald and the broadcaster and journalist Johnny Ward. Remember, our football coverage brought to you with thanks to Paddy Power. For more information on responsible gambling, visit dunlewy.net. Our text number is 53106 at a cost of 30 cents. You can tweet us at Off the Ball. You can watch us as well on YouTube, Facebook, on Periscope, on the new Go Loud app for OTB Sports. We're really excited about that being launched this week. This year's World Cup Revisited, our 12th episode, if I'm right. I'll have to go back and check that. It might be 13th or 12th, but I'll check that. That's not really important. But what is important is we're going to have a great chat over the next couple of hours about Argentina 1978. I wasn't old enough to remember it because I only arrived in October of that year. But as a tournament that is so controversial, so much political, societal issues to speak about, obviously the football as well. Guys, I'm really looking forward to this, and also discussing the other issues in football that have gone on through the week. We had John Egan on the show. We'll hear from him a little bit later on. He spoke to Nathan Murphy on Thursday night. We got the Bundesliga going on. We got the 2000 guineas. We'll give you the result of that as well. But lads, we didn't make it to Argentina. We weren't on the boat like the Scots were, because as usual with Ireland back then, we had dodgy refereeing decisions. We had France, we had Bulgaria in our group, and it just didn't work out for John Giles, who quit soon after.
Yeah, it is sort of another, as you say, another tale, John, of Irish woe. And it's strange. I think actually when, obviously the famous Irish breakthrough game was Bulgaria 1987, when Gary McKay got the winner for Scotland in Bulgaria. And I think from sort of skimming through coverage of that time, a lot of people assumed that just there's no way that a Bulgarian team needing to go through at home would fail to do it, because of perhaps from the Irish memory some legacy of some dodgy decisions in Bulgaria, and 10 years previously, yeah, as you mentioned, it was a three-team group. Albania dropped out, withdrew, and I mean, Ireland, you had a good Irish side. You would have had, as you mentioned, John Giles, who was on the way out subsequently, but you had Liam Brady coming towards his pomp, Frank Stapleton, you know, really good players. And, you know, they were capable of beating France at home, who were a top side at the time. But it seemed like the away game in Bulgaria, a disallowed goal. I think it was even the French manager Hidalgo was there and couldn't believe some of the decisions. And that sort of left Ireland behind the eight ball a bit. Now, they did lose in Paris. I think there was some contention over maybe aspects of that, and they couldn't beat Bulgaria at home at the end of the day. So maybe it wasn't, it's not maybe a scandal like the Belgium one a couple of years later, but nonetheless, again, it feels like a lot of these 70s, early 80s Ireland stories could have been different.
I don't think FIFA cared, lads, about Ireland until Italia 90, and they saw what our supporters brought to the tournament and how well received we were because of the way we behaved, and we really lit up the tournament from a fan's perspective. I almost think they didn't care about little old Ireland until then.
Yeah, and there were a lot of conspiracy theories, I suppose, around football, which we'll definitely get to, because this World Cup was laden with a lot of dodgy stuff going on, really, and that definitely extended to Ireland's group. Now, whether they were just unfortunate or whether there was something more sinister going on in some of the games. But, you know, John Giles had taken over from Liam Toohey, and Liam Brady was becoming a bit of a tour de force around that time. And Giles paid a lot of tribute to Toohey, where he brought the Irish team. They had serious, serious players at that time, and beat France 1-0 in Lansdowne Road. An unbelievable roar from the crowd. I suspect Ireland weren't playing in Lansdowne very long at that stage, but there was Liam Brady basically ran through the French defence and scored an unbelievable unbelievable goal. And as Dan kind of alluded to there, the game in Paris, Giles would say, John Giles, the player manager, would say subsequently that they had a goal really, really wrongly disallowed when the game was 1-0, and the French got a second goal. So 2-0 was quite flattering to the French. The problem, I suppose, for Ireland in that group was the fact that it was that three-team group, which I think is really, really unfair, because you have no margin for error, especially if things go against you, for only one team to qualify. And as much as France didn't have a great World Cup, they were a serious up-and-coming side, particularly with a young Michel Platini at that time. But Ireland didn't beat Bulgaria at Lansdowne Road. They were then sort of reliant on going over to Sofia, and it was almost thought it was a bit of a fait accompli that you just didn't get decisions over there. So they missed out, and this was on the back of a very exciting campaign for the Euros previously, which also resulted in failure. But Ireland weren't there. Scotland were the only team representing the home nations, as they called them. And Scotland didn't quite live up to expectations. But this was a pretty mad World Cup, John, and on an awful lot of levels, as we go through over the next hour and a bit.
Yeah, the team that beat France, lads, Mick Kearns, Paddy Mulligan, David O'Leary, Jimmy Holmes, Mick Marsh and Steve Highway, Liam Brady, Johnny Giles, Gerry Daly, Don Givens and Ray Tracy, some top players.
Yeah, and that was around the time that Giles was already coming back to Shamrock Rovers, you know, and this was, it's like there's, as we sort of alluded to there, there's so many false starts in Irish football, prior to, I suppose, the international breakthrough 10 years after this, which was in some respects a false start too, because we didn't really build structures upon it. But at an international level, and you mentioned some of those players again, O'Leary, you know, Gerry Daly was coming along. Like, you know, you would have, like, if Ireland had qualified for tournaments in the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s, when you look at where these players were, you know, how a lot of them were getting on in their club careers, they would have done okay. I mean, it was harder to qualify for tournaments. We sometimes talk about that era maybe in the context of failure, whereas obviously now you can have 24 teams in the Euros. Now, I know...
And there was only 16 in that World Cup as well.
Yeah,
it was the last 16-team World Cup, yeah.
Yeah, and listen, I know that the split of the USSR and Yugoslavia has created new nations and just made it more competitive, and three-team groups or four-team groups are a product of just... There was only around over 20-something teams in UEFA at the time. I think there was like 107 teams tried to qualify for this World Cup, where there'd be 211 trying to qualify for a FIFA one now. So, the failure then by scale, you know, might be equivalent still to qualification or very, very close to qualification now. But, it could have been different because, and we'll touch on it with Scotland. I mean, and England didn't qualify. And they didn't qualify for 74 either. And the Scotland team that did qualify, and I'm sure we will chat about them, I mean, they would have had a really elite team, because English teams around that time, were the kings of Europe. You had Nottingham Forest winning the European Cup. Ireland's players would have been playing at a similar level and in or around that company. So they wouldn't have been out of place in those tournaments at all.
Yeah, one of the great things about these World Cup chats we've had over the last few weeks is the way that organically interaction has really sparked them and really been the key to them. Hi, John. This is on 53106 for our texts and add off the ball on Twitter. Hi, John. Watching the FIFA film of 78 pitches seemed bad, even for 1978, and not much flair on show maybe because of it. And Scotland doing a Scotland again. Poor Addy McLeod got some stick after that, I recall. That is from Mark in Tala. Hi, lads. I'm 55 in West Cork. I fell in love with the game in 1978. The ticker tape, Luque, Kempes, Ozzy, the Dutch, Argentina against Peru. Padraig Crone in 1978 featured the first World Cup finals win for an African team in Tunisia, beating Mexico 3-1. They also drew with West Germany but didn't get out of their group. The long-range goals for Holland against Italy were also highlights. The first World Cup I've got a proper memory of. And Dan O'Callaghan, my parents brought me and my three siblings to a mobile home in Wexford in the family saloon with the family TV, so we wouldn't miss any of that World Cup, which was on RT, I remember. I think Eamon Dunphy was on the panel with Bill O'Hurley at the time. So your TV folks are beginning to get... colour, and you got the BBC, and you got David Coleman, and you got John Motson. And let's actually hear about this, Scott. So let's hear David Coleman's description of Archie Gemmell's goal against Holland in the group stage.
Luque, clip it! 1-0! Ardiles made that, battling through. Luque battle with Brent for it. sending through to Kempis. Kempis through the gap and into the net. Kennedy. There's an argument going on with the referee, between Rioch and the referee, who just wants to get on with it. Gemmell. Good play by Gemmell, and again. 3-1! A brilliant individual goal by this hard little professional has put Scotland in dreamland. The miracle is beginning to happen. They need one more to qualify. And Gemmell, first one, then two. Then he faced up his own player and another defender. He was clear, and finishing like this is lethal.
David Coleman was so iconic, guys. You played him twice there, Mario Kempes. We get the drift. Mario Kempes and then Archie Gemmell's goal against Holland. So let's speak about the Scots. Ali McLeod, he had success at Ayr United and Aberdeen. They knocked the European champions Czechoslovakia out of qualifying. They edged Wales to qualify. They'd beaten England 2-1 at Wembley in 1977. They had great players like Kenny Dalglish, Graeme Souness, who inexplicably wasn't picked in the game against Peru. But there was all these ads. It was like, you know, commercial advertising was being done by the manager and the players. His wife was doing ads for the co-op. It was a real hype machine from Scotland. And classically for the Scots, it turned into a tragic farce.
Yeah. Sorry, Dan. Yeah, they kind of screwed up basically by losing against Peru. And as you referenced there, JD, the decision was made initially not to play Souness, and Souness had a major hand when he actually did play in the tournament. This Scottish team was accused of being confident, bordering on even arrogant. And I suppose it being the only team from the British Isles as well, they had the weight of Britain somewhat behind them. And as you mentioned there, they were kind of celebrities. There was a lot of stuff going on that I think managers nowadays would absolutely scoff at, even nowadays. And they came into the group with high hopes, but they came up against Cabillas, who was probably, I think just reading on him today, he's deemed like the best player maybe Peru have ever produced. And it wasn't a bad Peru side who played a key role in the tournament for good and bad reasons. Scotland lost that. They were slightly on the back foot after that, but they had seriously outstanding players. And one of those teams that kind of could have gone a long way in the tournament if they'd gotten out of the group, because as much as Argentina won this tournament, and we've so much to talk about here. You mentioned everyone watching it on TV. This was, as you say, the first colour TV World Cup, and the whole background behind the Argentina at that time. But it wasn't a great Argentina side. You know, they did have Kempes, but Maradona was left at home. They completely rode their luck in the tournament. And Scotland would definitely, it was one of these times again when they went out on goal difference. But ultimately what did them was that game against Peru, which they lost the first game in the tournament that they played.
Yeah, I think the thing is that the Scots, I mean, every time we talk about the Scots in this series, we're sort of, here we go with Scotland. I think this is almost the peak Scotland one, because this was like Ali's army. And you alluded to it there, John, all the sponsorship deals that they did. There was with Chrysler cars. I think his wife was involved. He was speaking about, like, you know, making comments about winning the World Cup. And this goes back to Ali McLeod, like the start of his reign. I think even when Scotland went to play Wales in a friendly, and like Wales again, like had some very top players, and his opening gambit was along the lines of, well, I only know one of these Welsh players. I've only ever heard of one of them. I mean, like, he's from Scotland. It's not as if you're coming from Brazil, you know? So there was, I mean, it's the type of stuff that it was almost like Roddy Collins-esque stuff from like the late 90s, early 2000s. Like some of the stuff that almost sort of made a rod for his own back, pardon the pun. But there is.
You've been waiting all day to say that, haven't you?
I actually haven't. It's like worryingly.
Don't believe it, Johnny.
But that also, that overconfidence also had a. I mean, there was actually, that was tied in with their performance in terms of research and homework. There was I think the couple of months previously, there was I think a TV station had an all expenses paid trip lined up to go and watch Peru play like a friendly. And basically, Ali McLeod didn't turn up. I think he had some corporate engagement back in Scotland, and as a result, didn't do the homework on Peru, who I think they just dismissed as not being very good. I think even before the first game against Peru, you know, he spoke about the danger of one of their players and how it would be a challenge for Martin Buchan, and he basically had the wrong side. He was talking about, like, you know, the left back. when, you know, he should have been talking about the right back, basically. That was the extent. But yeah, some of the stuff, I mean, there was the World Cup song. I think even
that
at one
song,
point,
that song was actually very, very, very similar to the Horselips one we did in 1990. We're all part of Addy's Army. I was wondering where it came from. It's pretty much the same song.
But even of the time, I think they ended up shilling some basically cigarettes. Like, so they actually were involved in a pro smoking campaign. I think the comment that there was a Scott Murray piece in the Guardian, and McLeod's line was, "Several of our players smoke, so it would be untruthful to back an anti-smoking campaign." He said. So, I mean, this is,
they had a few 90s. Issues going on.
Willie Johnston being another one. So they lose 3-1 to Peru. Don Masson misses a penalty. Should have played Souness, didn't play Souness. It was a European Cup winner with Liverpool that season. Kubias, who played in the 1970 World Cup, is saying there, Johnny, a swerving free kick, a horror show for the Scots.
Free kick that you mentioned, John, actually, that like, you know, it was the Roberto Carlos anniversary there. What was it, 23 years, was it, this week, from that unbelievable goal that he got in that tournament. That goal by Cabillas, you're talking about a completely different ball. It was an outside of the foot around the wall, and I'd never seen it before, and I was kind of thinking, this is a goal that deserves an awful lot. In fairness to this tournament, there were some great strikes from outside the box, totally different football, much harder to do it back then, and Cabillas' goal against the Scots was outrageous. Like, it's well worth looking up if you haven't seen it.
5-3-1-0-6. Remember Scotland's abysmal performances against Peru and Iran, and then the Scotland are in dreamland commentary like it was yesterday. That is from Sean. Wow, folks, you brought back a memory of how World Cups influenced street football. For months afterwards, everyone would shout, "Murphy, 1-0, to be like David Coleman. That is from Dave in Bray. So 1-1 against Iran was just an absolute nightmare. And they need, as we just heard from David Coleman there, to beat the Dutch by three clear goals to qualify for the second group stage, which was effectively the last eight. And they beat Holland 3-2, but it wasn't enough. It's just an iconic goal from Archie Gemmell, who was playing for Nottingham Forest at the time, league champions in 1978 in England, slaloming through the Dutch defenders and sweeping at home. But the Scottish fans, all of those had travelled, like they were just, they turned on the players, they were making gestures at them. A brick was thrown through the window of the Scottish FA. It's you kind of laugh about it now, but I'm sure at the time, if you were a Scot, it wasn't very funny.
But they have an ability, though, the Scots, to lose the run of themselves around their national team. And it's sort of quite endearing. Like, it is like the, and we can be a small bit like it, but with the Scots, it's probably another level, because it is probably a much more passionate football country, really. Around that time, they'd won the home championships. I mean, Johnny keeps referring to the home nations and sticking us into it. It's kind of, we're going to get a couple of complaints about that. But there was the home nations, which we very much weren't in. But Scotland,
there is a complaint. There is a complaint.
Yeah, just to be clear.
Home nations, British Isles, iconic David Coleman. Is this a BBC satellite? You cannot make it up. Is it 1920?
There was home nations last week. I wouldn't mind. I know a young Johnny Ward used to have tricolours all over his website, so I'm shocked by this. But anyway, we're not very much a home nation. But Scotland did win it around that time, and you know, the fans were, you know, very much, you know, drank in the moment in every sense of the word. But then the disappointment was so crushing. But even like, Scotland haven't qualified for a major tournament since 1998, which is ludicrous. When you consider, again, like, that it is real a proper football country, like the highest attendances per capita in Europe, and has produced great players over the years, and John Giles did his team during the week, which sort of illustrates that fact. And they haven't been in a tournament for, what, 22 years. And even in Euro 2016, they just couldn't help themselves, because Ireland were in the qualifying group. And there was that time Scotland drew in Dublin in June 2015. And there was, like, Scottish players and fans and journalists on about booking their holidays in France the next summer and all this type of stuff. Like, they have an ability to, like, to really get ahead of themselves very quickly for some reason.
In fairness to them, Dan, at that stage, if this were a Scottish team that was good enough to beat the Netherlands 3-2 and that unbelievable goal from Gemmell. Yeah. And, you know, like, I spoke to Peter Fitzpatrick, a good buddy of mine, a Shamrock Rovers fan. So he's one of the old enough to text when we get to World Cups in the 70s. And he was telling me, to his mind, the Dutch were the best team in that World Cup. They were kind of jinxed in the final. But Scotland went and scored three goals against them. Souness was absolutely imperious in midfield. So the fact that they obviously got 1 point from Iran and Peru, and Peru ended up topping the group, Scotland would have looked at that game against, despite all of the disastrous preparations for that Dutch game, they nearly pulled it off. And they obviously were probably good enough to go very close in that tournament. They just screwed it up, as Scotland often do.
Yeah, they knocked out the European champions in qualifying. They were the best of the teams, England and Wales. They were the best of them. England didn't qualify, Italy pipped them. Tactical mistakes, playing Don Mason and Bruce Rioch against Peru, not playing Souness, not playing Gemmell earlier, and they don't qualify. So you've got 16 teams, a cold Argentina, of course, it's winter there. Four groups initially, seed four groups, Argentina, Italy, France and Hungary, Holland, Scotland, Peru and Iran, as we touched upon there, Brazil, Sweden, Spain and Austria, and West Germany, Poland, Mexico and Tunisia. Easy group for West Germany and Poland. Massive areas of the pitch and advertising hoardings behind the goals, nets sloped in an L shape quite significantly, quite an attractive thing to watch, but not the beloved Argentina of 1986 when the dictatorship had finished. So what's the background to this? Well, there was a military coup in Argentina in 1976, General Jorge Videla's dictatorship. Why did that happen? Well, Juan Perón died in 1974. His wife, Isabelita, who was ruling, lost control. You had a Weimar situation with right-wingers, left-wingers, political assassinations, the aftershocks of the oil crisis, 300% inflation, a recipe for complete disaster when you've already got South American countries having a delicate relationship with democracy anyway, with Brazil already being in a military dictatorship, with the Americans supporting Allende's being deposed in Chile in 1973 with General Pinochet taking over. So you have this pure, Argentina had already been awarded the World Cup back in the 60s, but you had this PR campaign and you had $700 billion spent by the regime, the junta, on the Argentina World Cup that got protests from Amnesty International. You had 30,000 people murdered over that time. You had torture and detention camps around the stadiums, and you had the mothers of the disappeared walking every Thursday, I think it was, to the Plaza del Mayo. So you had this military dictatorship running the best and the biggest, one of the biggest, and probably the biggest apart from the Olympic sporting events in the world. And it's a crazy time, guys. And what really made me quite sad about when I was doing the research on this is the drugging and throwing political prisoners into the sea. That memory hasn't really left me the last few days.
Yeah, the literally throwing them into the sea with weights around their ankles. This was not a good time to be in Argentina. And, you know, Perón and his wife, whilst they might be slightly controversial figures, they are really, really iconic in Argentina. And I did a bit of research in Argentina of today. And the leader, the president of Argentina, is from a party that is basically pro-Perón and was kind of born out of the Perón movement. And obviously his wife passed away. But Argentina right now, just like back then, is very, very susceptible to, you know, basically the economy being ruined. But it has managed the coronavirus extremely well. The number of deaths in Argentina is a real credit to the country. I think it's like 320 or something like that. It's very, very small. And meanwhile, Brazil is closer to 12,000. So Argentina is trying to kind of find its rightful place in South America. But at that time, One of the really intriguing things was the logo for that World Cup was essentially based on Juan Perón putting his hands like this, kind of addressing a crowd. So the logo was made whilst he was, if he weren't still alive, his wife was still in power at the time. Then the coup was arranged, and obviously the coup came in, and they realised that the World Cup logo, which is quite an important thing, they realised that it was basically based on the hand gesture of the former leader. So obviously the military coup didn't want anything to do with this, but they found out that it was so costly to change it that it basically wasn't feasible. So they had to reluctantly go along with it, but. You know, there are clear echoes of Berlin in 36 here and Mussolini in 34, because in the Berlin Olympics, obviously, in 36, because it was a very, very dodgy regime basically trying to legitimize itself. And you mentioned the color TVs. Spoke to Nathan Murphy's dad, Michal, before the show, and he was saying it was remarkable because pretty much everyone in Ireland who had a TV, they were color TVs at that time. So this was a remarkable thing for people to see. But back in Argentina, they still had black and white TVs, despite the fact, as you mentioned, JD, the regime had absolutely lashed money at this. And it got me thinking as well, Argentina now, I think you've been there, Dan, have you?
I have, yeah.
Yeah, so it's a country I'd love to go to. But I was just thinking, it must be a fantastic place to go for another World Cup, because, you know, Bach and River Plate's average crowds are around about 45,000. I was looking into it. I think 8 of the teams in the Argentinian league have an average crowd of at least 25,000. It's obviously a football mad nation, so it'd be a great place to go back. And if I ever do visit Argentina, I'd love to go for a World Cup. But if it were 1978, I think I'd have deep reservations about going, as you mentioned, JD. 30,000 people, horrible, horrible regime. And we referenced this 2 weeks ago in terms of, there's been a lot of chat about the US, obviously over the past week, but the US was again quite influential in this World Cup in a kind of a strange way, because it helped that regime get into power.
And Henry Kissinger was in the semi-final dressing room. Well, it wasn't the semi-final, but the Peru, when they needed to win by 4 goals, Henry Kissinger and Videla, the dictator, visited the dressing room of the Peruvians. Why?
Yeah, like, that's an extraordinary story. Just to roll back a small bit, I mean, it is like there's a brilliant piece by a guy called David Forrest, and he's involved with the In Bed with Maradona website. I think it was reproduced in The Guardian a couple of years back, and he was in Buenos Aires a couple of years back. I think it was like the 40-year anniversary of the World Cup. And actually had if people decide to look up the footage of this after our discussion, and they look at the YouTube clips or whatever, you might notice that at the goals all have a black sticker at the bottom of the goalpost. So the white goalposts are all, you know, it's a perfectly shaped, you know, goalpost and crossbar, but at the bottom there's a black sticker on either side of the net. And this author wondered about it for years. Like, what was the story with this black on the goalposts? And he essentially did this piece, David Forrest's piece. He sought to find out the reasons behind this. He went to the ground, went to a museum. He was talking to a waiter in a restaurant one time who said, you should go and see this person. And they went to the stadium, and you know, they got a tour, and they asked someone about the pictures and said, what's the story with that little black at the bottom of the goalposts? And they said, well, we can't really talk about this, but here's someone you should ask. And it turned out it was the waiter back in the restaurant who sent him to the stadium, who was part of the ground staff in 78. And effectively, because the regime actually was pretty clueless about football, they only become interested in it in the month or so before the tournament, really. That, you know, they were sort of very keen, as you mentioned, for propaganda reasons, to present the best image. And the thing about the goal nets and the shape, there was, you know, the ground staff wanted to make a protest. They wanted to reflect the fact that people in Argentina weren't happy. They thought about carving stuff into the pitch or whatever, but they'd all be killed for that. They'd be taken away and thrown out of the plane. So they decided to tell the regime that it was a football tradition to put these black stickers at the bottom of the goalpost, but they were actually symbolizing a black armband. That's what it was. And it was like the ground staff's little gesture to the world that something wrong was going on in Argentina. And people there understood that the black at the bottom of the goalpost was their mark of respect for the people that were, you know, that were being tortured and killed. And also, like, not far from the ground as well. This was the thing. These torture camps were in the center of the city. You know, they were not out in the countryside. I mean, the shouts, you know, were almost drowned out by the cheers from the stadium. So, I mean, it was a horrendous time. And it's funny, you give that opening speech, John, there, just about the political situation and the dictatorship and, you know, what a country this was. And you're thinking, yeah, this is all the ingredients for a place FIFA will bring a World Cup, you know, because that's generally where they bring World Cup.
And it was Havelange's first World Cup. It was João Havelange's first World Cup, but it was given to them in the 60s. But he did nothing about it. It was all, no, we don't get involved in politics. And they were also starting their kind of road towards, what was this? It was a mixture of corporate sponsorship. It was a mixture of global TV. And they didn't want to rock the boat because they had eyes on Spain. They had eyes on Mexico or Colombia in 86. And let's just get this done. Oh, we don't interfere in politics. And that's a very noble thing. But when you see how FIFA then ended up, then you'd have to say that.
It wasn't noble. It was rubbish. It was a lie. I mean, the organizer for the competition was assassinated.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Beforehand, and I mean, Havelange's politics would have been questionable. I mean, Brazil, who won it in 1970, I mean, Brazil was a dictatorship at that time too, and that was, you know, Avalanche came from Brazil and that football background. So, I mean, FIFA knew what it was at, really. But John's point was about, you know, Argentina is a terrific place, very European. It still considers itself very European. Wouldn't actually be very popular with the other South American nations because they would be viewed as almost the Europeans of South America. But, I mean, this is why there's going to be a big push for the 2030 World Cup to go to Argentina and Uruguay together, because you can get a boat to Uruguay from Buenos Aires. It's a simple boat across the river, and that's almost like the traditional 100 years on from 1930. And to bring maybe a proper World Cup to Argentina, that's not tainted. But of course, you know, last I heard, our lot are still trying to go in and organise our own bid for that competitions. But I'd have my view about that. We should concentrate on other stuff.
What I meant there was, it's noble for FIFA to say they don't want to get involved in politics and don't get the governments involved, but we know that's not really credible given what happened to them subsequently. But actually, to be fair to the Argentinians, like Cesar Menotti was a chain-smoking leftist. The players, I think, were probably a bit afraid.
There's no
situation.
Doubt they were afraid. So
they therefore, like Ricky Villa was saying, that it probably shouldn't have happened. Luque, he definitely had a relation or somebody he knew who was killed. And Ardiles, once again, was just brought into it and didn't really want to comment upon it. And he kind of felt at the time that, look, we just believed what we were. I think they were just effectively of the view that we're going to keep our mouths shut about this.
You see, that's the thing. The thing about dictatorships, you know, you look at what happens in these countries and you sort of blame the people for going along with it. And how could the Germans let what happened in the war happen? But dictatorships don't work like that. You effectively don't really have a choice. And it would have been very difficult. I imagine a lot of the Argentinian players were abhorrent, really, like absolutely hated the regime. But again, as you mentioned, John, there was probably a fear there. And, you know, if you're to read into this... As generally, I think historians have, like, there was so much fear, either a fear that actually was justified or a fear that might have been slightly overstated. That, you know, there were some games in this tournament that effectively, you'd have to look back on and say, well, was that actually a fair result? What happened there? And one of them was obviously Argentina and Peru, which is probably roundly concerned, and that was in the second round, to have been a fixed game, because Argentina also, they knew that they could delay the game, so they knew exactly what they wanted points wise and so there's a lot of stuff going on, and the Henry Kissinger stuff is absolutely bonkers. But it's sad that, you know, that regime was there for that long, because Argentina, like, what a country, and that idea of a World Cup with Uruguay would be amazing. And there are strong Irish links to Argentina as well. Admiral William Brown, and even Sarsfield is a name that's fairly common in Argentina. So it's a place that would be amazing if Ireland ever did get to the World Cup there.
Yeah, and also it was actually the Falklands War that put paid to the regime. It wasn't Videla who was in charge by then, but that is actually what precipitated the return to democracy. And it's always, as I said, it's always been fragile in South America, the actual democratic movement. 53106 for the text. We'll talk about the football after the break. Lawrence says, easily my favourite World Cup, 13 years old, so oblivious to the politics, but what atmosphere. You just had to want Argentina to win. I've been a fan ever since, loved watching Maradona and Messi, but neither as much as this team, Kempes. In block capitals and in exclamation marks. Eamon, the tournament that made me fall in love with football. The fans, the ticker tape, the drama, the controversy, Gemmell's goal, the rock star that was Mario Kempes. Soft spot for Argentina ever since. Derek Foran was 11. Mario Kempes, Argentina, dodgy win against Peru, Archie Gemmell and Johnny Rep for the Dutch. Peter Clark was about to turn 11. Scotland's disaster, the late starting final, the group semi-final format, Ari Hahn's shots, Nelinho's goal against Italy, Quiroga, Cubillas, but most of all, the tango ball, the ticker tape, Leopoldo Luque, and that god among men, Mario Kempes. What a summer. Hi guys, I've just qualified for the pension, so you can guess my age. I just moved to Toronto in 1978 when unfortunately CBC went on strike, and subsequently there was no coverage of the games. So me and my brother paid $20 each to watch the final on a big screen at Maple Leaf Gardens, home of Toronto Maple Leafs hockey team at the time. Not very good sound quality, but great atmosphere, and the Toronto Argentine contingent went nuts at the end. Loving the discussion. That is from Tom and Maynooth. 53106 for your text. Add off the ball on Twitter. This is Off the Ball Saturday. Back after this. You are welcome back to Off the Ball Saturday on News Talk. John Duggan with you through to 5 o'clock in the company of the Irish Independent football correspondent Daniel McDonnell and the broadcaster and journalist Johnny Ward. Our football coverage brought to you with thanks to Paddy Power. For more information on responsible gambling, visit dunlewy.net. You can text us on 53106. You can tweet us at Off the Ball. You can watch us on the Go Loud app. But obviously, you obviously should know now by this date that we now have a new OTB Sports app. You can download it at the iOS store or Android. So check out the OTB Sports app and definitely download it. News, analysis, podcasts, interviews. It's a great app and we're really excited about it here this week. Just a text on the 1978 World Cup, our feature year today. The 1978 World Cup, the first one I can remember, the ticker tape thrown onto the pitch before the final was a great sight. If environmentally questionable, Admiral William Brown from Foxford, County Mayo, founded the Argentinian Navy. There are a large number of Argentinians with Irish ancestry. That is from Martian. Well done Off the Ball again. One of the best matches from the tournament was France and Hungary. I wrote my English essay on the match for my inter certificate in English. Oh, I also fell in love with the tennis player Gabriella Santini years later. That is from Nolan Kildare. Am I right in thinking that during the World Cup in 1978, at the France Hungary game, one of the teams had to borrow a strip from the local team because the blue and red jerseys were indistinguishable on a local black and white TV? I remember rightly the borrowed jerseys were green and white stripes, as from Daglon O'Kelly. That is correct, Daglon. Danny in Galway, people forget Johan Cruyff pulled out of the 78 World Cup after arguments with management. Also, Franz Beckenbauer had also retired from international football, aged just 32. The Guineas has been won at Newmarket by Cameco. Oisin Murphy, the Kerry champion jockey in England, has won it from Wichita, with Pinatubo, the favourite, beaten guys. But Johan Cruyff didn't not turn up in Argentina because there were row with management. He didn't turn up because he was kidnapped in 1977 in Spain when he was playing for Barcelona at the time. A gun was put to his head. His wife escaped, thankfully, during the incident, and he was under armed guard then for months, and it rattled him, and he wasn't going to go down to South America and leave his family.
Yeah, it's an incredible story, really, because there was obviously a bit of conjecture around, because we spoke about the 74 World Cup a couple of weeks back, and people listened to that series, and obviously there was a talk of some nefarious activities in the Dutch camp towards the final of that competition. And actually, one of the stories was that his wife basically said, "No more World Cups for you." But you know, years later, this story transpired, and I mean, there are still people who doubt it. I think, although I don't know, it was quite comprehensive. The incident that happened on the kidnapping, as I mentioned, was, but people wonder, was there other reasons why he didn't want to go? And that's why probably that text comes from, and there's different sort of versions of it out there. But yeah, long story short is, I mean, he didn't go. And Paul Breitner also actually didn't go
for the Maoist
for Germany as well. Yeah, who we spoke about,
my
him
Champions League friend,
74.
Yeah.
And a couple of people had objections to it, and there was obviously protests and stuff that you mentioned. But yeah, basically, you know, Holland ended up without their best player, yet as Johnny alluded to earlier, you know, they were felt by many to be the best team in the tournament. And I mean, they had the missed chance against Argentina in the final, late on, hit the post. And God, it's just both of those World Cups in the 70s could easily have been a story of Dutch victory and, you know, Dutch domination, and a completely different description of that era. But I mean, it was obviously a very European heavy tournament, just in terms of how the qualification was still structured. Like, Tunisia had the first African win, but I mean, there'd be one team representing those continents, and yet, you know, you'd have stacks of European participants by comparison. But that Dutch team did seem to be the pick of them. They just couldn't get over the line in final competitions.
I'll just give you that Guinea's result in full. Cameco 10-1, Wichita 15-2, Pinatubo, the 6-5 on favourite, was third. So
Aiden, not a great, John.
Yeah, I'm back Wichita, so I'm kind of anyway.
You told me beforehand, Aiden O'Brien, I was talking to him yesterday, he was very, very confident of a big run from Wichita, and how close he went. As you mentioned, Oisin Murphy, another win for Kingman as well, sire that's going to have a great career. But ultimately, Pinatubo I thought was a bit disappointing. I thought he'd every chance. It doesn't look like he's trained on to much extent anyway, but it was very, very nearly an Aidan O'Brien win in the Guineas, and Frankie Dettori on board. That would have been quite a story, albeit there's no one there.
The Bundesliga scores: Bayer Leverkusen 1, Bayern Munich the leaders 3, Eintracht Frankfurt 0, Mainz 1, Fortuna Dusseldorf 1, Hoffenheim 1, and RB Leipzig 1, Paderborn 0. At half 5 is Borussia Dortmund against Hertha Berlin. Some text in here on 53106 and some tweets out off the ball on the 1978 World Cup. Hi guys, first World Cup I really experienced, incredibly exciting, seeing the exotic foreign players. Loved Argentina, Kempis, Cobias goal and Peru kit. Goalie called Dropsy. Redhead Boniek, Scotland being the only familiar faces we knew, although they tanked when they really should have done better. Thanks to you all, the OTB team, when these World Cup reviews getting us through the lockdown. That is from Senan. Thank you, Senan. I stayed up late as an 8-year-old to watch Italy beat Argentina 1-0. Am I correct to recall Roberto Bettega scored the winner? That is from Aaron. Yes, I think you were right, Aaron. I was 8 years old. The biggest memory was the ticker tape of the final. Always remember that. It's from John and Killarney. Kempis was great, as was Luque, but tried to find a goal scored by Argentina, which did not include the wonderfully created of Ozzy Ardiles. He was the heartbeat of the team in 78. That is from Tony Wexford. Argentina, amazing people, but poorly run country. Football, the only escape for the people. No money in football, so they cannot keep good players at home. It was one of the biggest economies in the early 20th century. Was at a Boca game. You have to go there. Oh, the wine and the steak is amazing too. That is from Joe. And lads, yeah, like Luque was playing for River Plate, so was the keeper, Filol. But Mario Kempis was the top scorer in Spain. He scored 28 goals in 34 La Liga games that season for Valencia.
Yeah, he was the only, sorry, John, I was going to say he's the only overseas player in the squad. And this was part of Menotti's plan that prior to, you know, when they... from the long lead into the tournament, he didn't want any of their players to go overseas so they could prepare them at home. But Kempes was the one exception that was away. And I mean, it is striking watching the footage that he was involved in all the major moments in the latter stages. He didn't score in the groups actually, but it was more that he came to life later in the competition. And it was clearly a very good Argentina side. I mean, they had good players, and obviously this was the trigger for Ardiles and Ricky Villa and a sort of a piece of Spurs history, and you know, Passarella, who I think was, you know, was it John Giles who gave him a big mention a while back, who was like the legendary sort of captain and enforcer figure of the team. And you know, they would have played Ireland in 79 and 80, so clearly we were probably happy enough with the regime at the time, which wouldn't be out of sync with our history either. The fact is that Peru game is still, and you talked about it before the break, and we are trying to move on from the politics a bit yet. Like, that is the most famous game of the tournament, was the Argentina-Peru game, where Argentina needed to win by 4 clear goals, and they scored 6. And the FIFA film, it's there's a line at the start, because Peru hit the post with 2 minutes, after 2 minutes, and I think there was a line in the film about, well, Peru were giving it their all, or words to that effect, as though people think that like the reason that match fixing happens in world football and hasn't gone away is because people are quite good at it. So they tend not to you know, make it too comedic. And if they make it too comedic, it's a bit of a problem. And I mean, listen, there's still we still have to give people the benefit of the doubt. But
it wasn't the keeper. The keeper was born in. It wasn't the keeper. The keeper couldn't.
It's never just the keeper, John. Yeah, it can never just be the keeper.
This is the thing, Dan. You basically, people don't understand. You really only need 2 players to fix a game. And you know, they can do it in a reasonably subtle way as well.
But they went into the... So at the time, Peru was also in a, you know, under a regime which wasn't too pleasant. And I mean, there's been documentaries made about this. There's a film made about this. There's a senator who spoke about it a couple of years back. There is the fact that Videla went into the dressing room with Henry Kissinger. I mean, just like you say it out loud, and it's like,
all right, lads, how's it going? You look forward to a good game.
Who's that? You know, oh, that's the local dictator, and that guy was Secretary of State under Nixon. Not that I'm not sure the Peruvians might be up in there on the Watergate now, but still, like it is sort of, you know, you can't avoid the fact that Peru were a good team. Like, Peru had beaten Scotland 3-1, who were a good side, even if they were overconfident. Okay, Brazil had beaten them comfortably, and Argentina screwed over Brazil here by scoring more goals than they did. But, I mean, they capitulated completely. There was prisoners going back and forth between Argentina and Peru, and this was tied in with that because a lot of the questionable regimes would have worked together. There was a story about a massive grain shipment being involved involved. There was a visit to the hotel, I think, a couple of days previous as well. And there is no doubt that the Peruvian performance was out of sync with Peruvian ability. And it just so happened that the team run by a dictator hosting the country managed to somehow win 6-0 to get into the final. I think the speculation about it, sometimes where there's no smoke without fire, it's actually true.
There is the possibility that Argentina would have been good enough to get the required victory, because in fairness to Peru, like watching their goals they conceded against Brazil, they weren't great defensively, and it's not inconceivable.
You can have a result. I mean, Holland hammered Austria 5-1, and Austria were top their group, so it can happen. But it just, everything around it suggests that the Peruvian team didn't put up their best performance on the day.
Yeah, and but you know, this basket case situation. Now this World Cup, these were the days of the two groups, which was before my time. I wouldn't be a fan of it at all. So it was like 16 teams, then it was two groups of four, and the winners would go to contest the final. But not only that, you know, the Argentina were basically able to delay the Peru game such that they knew exactly what was required. So FIFA ended up changing the rules, obviously a bit too late, such that the last couple of games would go on at the same time. And then as when we get to the final, I mean, before the final, they ended up objecting to this really spurious case of one of the Dutch players having some sort of strapping on his hand for an injury, and I think the game was delayed. First of all, they came out late, 5 minutes late or something like that, like Dominic Cummings, albeit not quite as late. And then they objected to your man with the hand
wrapped,
and also the atmosphere, albeit I'm sure a lot of the crowd hated the regime. They did hate their football team, and the atmosphere at those games, as Micheál Murphy was saying to me, all the paper and the ticker tape, unbelievably hostile atmosphere for the Dutch team, and at the same time they very nearly did it, but a very, very tainted World Cup to Judy.
Yeah, just to mention some of the other teams as well, like Austria beat Germany for the first ever time. Hans Krankl was a really good footballer, scored like some incredible goals. I was even looking at the Austria-Germany game, the 3-2 win over West Germany. Two absolute cracking goals, and he ended up at Barcelona. The Germans didn't seem like a happy camp. The Dutch effectively eliminated them with the 2-2 draw. Beckenbauer was paid to go to the New York Cosmos, got a huge deal to go over there, and no player was allowed to play abroad, according to the German FA. Gerd Müller had retired by that stage. Italy seemed to run out of puff, but they had really good players, and they were kind of working towards the situation where they'd win it 4 years later. They'd Rossi, they'd Tardelli, they'd Bedega, they beat France 2-1. They were looking like a potential finalists. But just before we go to the breakdown, Ari Hahn's goal was the winner against Italy, and you've got a kind of funny story, I think, on Twitter about that. But we'll come to that after the break. We just got to take a break here in a moment, in 30 seconds. We'll come to that after the break. It's quite a good story about Holland's win over Italy. This is the World Cup chat about 1978. On the Argentina-Ireland connection, lads didn't remember the Christian Brothers, but didn't they influence and introduce rugby to Argentina, the Christian Brothers? Augustin Creevy, the most capped Argentina rugby international of all time. We're back after the news on 53106. This is Off the Ball Saturday. You are welcome back to Off the Ball Saturday on News Talk. John Duggan with you through till 5 o'clock in the company of the football correspondent of the Irish Independent, Daniel McDonald, and the broadcaster and journalist, Johnny Ward. Remember, our football coverage brought to you with thanks to Paddy Power. For more information on responsible gambling, visit dunlewy.net. You can text us on 53106. You can tweet us at Off the Ball. And we're streaming live as well. You can watch us on the Off the Ball social channels for Periscope and Twitter at Off the Ball, on YouTube and on Facebook. And if you missed our Saturday panel discussion on coaching in Irish soccer with Niall O'Regan, Jason Donoghue, and Pearl Slattery, you can check out the podcast of it on our brand new OTB Sports app. Download it now for iOS and Android. Search OTB Sports in the App Store. Really good stuff in the app, and really worth downloading. We're delighted to have launched it this week. Texting the World Cup a few weeks after the final, I saw Ardiles and Villa making their Spurs debut against Bohemians at Derryman Park. A great, great World Cup, but it should never have taken place. That is from Kieran in Dublin. It was a real coup for Spurs to get the pair of them to go to England. And it's bizarre, but they really did make an impact. Villa in the FA Cup in 1981, and then Ardiles was effectively there for a decade and was a major influential player on Spurs.
Yeah, coup was probably the wrong word to use, John, but it definitely was. I mean, and we think of Ozzy Ardiles as well. The fact that he ended up sort of managing Swindon and sort of like embarking on a very sort of different path probably in his football life than he would have expected, and you remember more than me, because you probably, I don't know, did it influence you in terms of getting into Spurs or whatever? When I was only born in 82, I don't know if you remember the 81, the Ricky Villa run at the time, or was it something you just grew up watching afterwards? But it obviously must have been hugely exciting. There would have been a slight influx of foreign players around that time, because you would have had Arnold Murren and various people dropping in, but they were still the extreme minority, those overseas players. And then for them to end up there while the Falklands sort of kicked off. And Artigas, I think you spoke earlier about the Argentina players and how they felt about it. I mean, they, like he was college educated. Like, he probably did feel he had a sense of what maybe was going on and just couldn't accept, he had to just wonder, was that the case? But, Luque obviously denounced it a couple of years afterwards. But clearly with Ardiles, it set him off on an unbelievable journey.
Yeah, and I remember Ardiles, John, and I'm sure you remember quite well when he managed Spurs and just what was a very cavalier style of football.
5-4 every game.
Yeah, it was great. Klinsmann was playing, and I was infatuated with the Premier League at that time, and Spurs were great value. But you do have to wonder about the decision not to bring Maradona, because Maradona was 17 at the time and obviously was already known to be this prodigy. But when you do look back, you mentioned the pitches. The pitch was absolutely horrendous for the final and a lot of other games, but it was also very, very physical. Referees were fairly reluctant to give out cards, so it would have been intriguing for Maradona, as much as he would have had the backing of an adoring fan base already, who would have just taken to this genius. He would have gotten kicked an awful lot, so it might have been a debatable decision not to bring him along, but he obviously came along subsequently. But Ozzy Ardiles was the man at that time, he and Kempes, and he did look incredible in that World Cup, to be fair.
Well, the Brazilians, there was a suspicion that they were deliberately sent to Mar del Plata, which had the worst pitches to stifle their fluid play. They didn't lose a game in the tournament, but they were seen as quite a functional team. There was an unhappy camp. Rivellino wasn't match fit, it seemed. Didn't really turn up until the Italy playoff. Zico was unsettled in the camp. Claudio Coutinho was the manager, but effectively he was being
undermined
and almost an overriding of his decisions by Admiral Nunes, the president of the federation. Once again, a military dictatorship calling the shots. Sadly, he lost his life a year later, Claudio Coutinho.
Yeah. They were saying that they were burning effigies of him in the streets in Rio and so on. Obviously he was a derided figure, but like, Brazil were very unfortunate that World Cup. Things went against him. There were issues, but as you say, then I think around a year later he tragically died. So it was a very sad footnote to a team that probably were better than Argentina, but just didn't get the look that the Argies got.
It's one of these phoenix from the flames. It was from the Bedil and Skinner show in the 90s. The Clive Thomas, the Welsh referee, blowing up when a corner was taken in the middle of the corner, and Brazil scored out of it against Sweden, and it wasn't allowed.
That was absolutely bonkers. I actually watched The Phoenix from the Flames again as a kid. I used to love watching that show on Friday nights before the Premier League and the Saturday. And, the Phoenix from the Flames, these were characters that obviously were old for me. But, I think technically he kind of was within his right. But you don't give a corner and then blow up when the ball is essentially... Apparently he said it to the goalkeeper. Like, he said it to the Swedish goalkeeper, I am going to blow it up. And if you note the Swedish goalkeeper, it doesn't really make much of an attempt to save the ball. But I don't think he ever refereed a World Cup game again.
Stephen from Dublin has actually just texted in exactly about that, the 1978 World Cup memory. I remember Rob Rensenbrink hitting the post against Argentina in the final with 2 minutes remaining when Woodall. That is from John in Waterford. Let's hear some of the local commentary of that Argentina-Holland final on the 25th of June, 1978 in Buenos Aires.
Gallego, juegue para Atlantis, devuelve para Gallego. Cuidado, cuidado, pelota para Ardiles, cuidado. Se las lleva Ardiles entre dos, bien, buena gambeta. Entra Luque, ganchó para Kempes, peligro, tiro, gol.
You wonder where that came from, guys, that kind of concept.
one for you, Dan, I think, is it?
The concept of the commentators just saying in South America, just go. Oh,
it's part of the whole experience, you know, and it is, you know, we spoke before about what was the local sentiment like during that. And I think Menotti in a speech before the final, and as you mentioned earlier, John, he was very much, he was a left-wing figure who I think even Videla was almost pragmatic enough that he knew he had to almost stick with him because he was good at his job and he might deliver the win even if he wasn't one of them. But I think he did give a speech before the final about how this was for, like, you know, the taxi drivers and the labourers and the people that would be in the crowd in a football mad country. And that, you know, so they were still able to enjoy it, the people that were there. I mean, you saw in the official film the scenes of the final and whatever it might be, that there was still some joy derived from it. And the commentary experience, and you go to a tournament in Brazil in 2014 in particular, I guess you would be a small bit exposed to it, and it is. Like, it definitely does, like, evoke images of the passion of the crowd and the passion of the commentators. And even I mean, it's sort of a South American, Central American thing. Even that Maradona in Mexico documentary, which I recommend on Netflix, even if there's small crowds at the games, the commentator still has to let rip. Whereas I don't know, I can't imagine Dave McIntyre setting off that route now on a Premier League.
Dave McIntyre doesn't need to.
Nathan, give it a bash, actually.
Nathan, they don't need to. These guys are top pros. They don't need to. They don't need to put in goal. They can just do that brilliant 10-second wrap.
John, I think they'd want to do it a bit more passionately than that. Now, to be fair.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm still upset about Wichita losing.
Yeah, your mood has notably gone down since the Guineas, it has to be said.
Yeah, well, you know, that's the story of my life. The story of my life, lads. But the final was interesting in that Argentina scored first through Kempes. Robertson Brink nearly won it for the Dutch. They'd Dirk Nanninga scoring the equaliser. You just wish they'd had Cruyff, though. They'd had Cruyff, they would have won the World Cup. And then in extra time, Argentina scored again through Kempes and Bertoni. And that was it. In Russia, the Argentinian fans are the most passionate I definitely encountered. I thought they were incredible. And you just saw the ticker tape. I mean, for a scene, for that alone, you'd almost want them to win the World Cup just for that ticker tape celebration. Imagine being in that ground. And if there's one game in the world I would want to go and see before I depart this mortal coil, it's Boca Juniors against River Plate in the Bombonera.
Yeah, literally just took the words out of my mouth there. I'd love to see that game. I've been to a few fairly interesting kind of places around the world to look for, I suppose, a proper atmosphere. And, you know, if you look up YouTube for the San Lorenzo fans, they have this chant. It's absolutely mesmerizing. That just goes on and on and on. It's probably the best football chant I've ever found. But yeah, imagine the Boca, the River Plate, the iconic jerseys, going to see Argentinian fans looking at their own. You don't really, you know, take much notice, I suppose, of South American football here. But the Dutch were up against that, John, as well. You know, if this tournament were played in Holland, in Europe, even, I very little doubt that the Dutch would have been able to beat Argentina. And part of the reason is they would have had Cruyff. The pitch was appallingly bad for the final. You know, you mentioned the time of year, but I don't know how they ended up playing in a pitch as bad as that in the final. And they hit the posts just before the end of full time, the Dutch. And in fairness, as much as we've a lot of conspiracy theories, it looks like they were going to go on and legitimately win the game had that ball gone 2 inches, 4 inches closer into the goal. But Argentina won, and the rest is history.
Well, they've got out alive, though.
Presentation would have been interesting anyway, because I think that was the thing. That was even the fact that, it's very hard for the Argentina players to go back and look at the photos, I think, of the final. I mean, like, you think of 86 and there's those iconic photographs of Maradona, but in 78 it's Videla's right in the middle of it. So they don't necessarily, you know, it doesn't necessarily feature, I don't think, too, you know, prominently on their old reeling in the years or whatever. You know, it actually did. The fact that he was so to the centre of the whole celebration, you do wonder. I mean, I don't know. Yeah, what would have happened if that goal goes in? It would have been a more subdued celebration, or maybe for, you know, whatever Argentina player was deemed to have been responsible for their goal. You know, life could have got uncomfortable, because it was the goalkeeper a year later actually talked about leaving. I'm not sure what club the goalkeeper was at, but whatever club he was going to leave, you probably have the list there. It might have been River Plate, I think, but I'm not sure.
Just feel all it was at River Plate, yeah.
Yeah, but Philly Isle it was, yeah. And yeah, the suggestion he was going to leave, you know, there was a gun put on the table and he was told by the general, who was particularly passionate, well, you know, I could make life very difficult for you if you decided to do that. So he didn't. So it clearly did, obviously, you know, there was that influence that even the players themselves didn't feel fully safe after winning the World Cup, which probably shows you how terrible a regime it was. It is true. Like the other side of the post, and might have been a lot of injury time, maybe.
We haven't mentioned, JD, maybe that Tunisia were in this tournament, and I mentioned them for a reason here, because obviously they were the first African team to win a game at the World Cup, and just watching the highlights, this was a decent team, and Africa, as much as North Africa and sort of the rest of Africa is almost like kind of two different continents in a way, Africa really united behind Tunisia. But one of the teams they played was Mexico. Now, Mexico were pretty poor, it has to be said, but there was this utterly bizarre incident before. I can't remember who they were playing, possibly playing Brazil, but whoever they were playing, before the game, the Mexican players were all out in the pitch waving the Argentinian flag.
That's right, yeah, that's right.
Absolutely bizarre. Now, I was getting to thinking, what was the Mexican regime like at that time? Were they kind of, was this a nod to the junta, or what was it? But in any event, or maybe they just wanted the crowd to get behind them. But yeah, you can imagine the Mexican team waving this massive Argentinian flag before one of their own games. Absolutely bizarre.
I can't imagine us doing it in a World Cup.
Well, not an English flag anyway, but probably not any flag, really.
To be fair, we did actually, our team did give a salute in Germany back in the 30s, didn't we? And it was one or two players didn't partake in that. It was Jimmy Dunn, I think, and one or two others who resisted it. But we do have a habit of trying to ingratiate ourselves into the local tradition. So, I mean, if the Green Army had gone there in 78, I'm sure we would have gotten a couple of photographs and might have regretted afterwards, to be fair.
Well, one of the interesting things I was reading up about, that the West Germans were visited in Cordoba by the former Nazi colonel Hans-Ulrich Rudel, who organised Perón's Air Force. This is at a time when Sepp Maier was very vehemently against what was going on and regarding his participation in the World Cup, and he was one of the few people taking a stand. And of course, he had a lot of former Nazis going down to South America, Mengele being one of them at the time, and Eichmann,
absolutely,
I think, was captured as well.
He was in
that part of the world. Angels with Dirty Faces, A Super History of Argentina Football. This is from Jonathan Wilson. I remember this book. The quote about people who like football like Brazil, whilst people who love football love Argentina, has always resonated with me. That is from Tom on 53106.
Another thing that's quite interesting was I'm not all that aware of, you know, Argentina's colonial history or whatever, but they were very, it seemed anyway, when Spain played, they were very pro the Spanish team, which is interesting. So they seem to be fully behind the Spaniards as well.
Lads, the Dutch had decided before the game that because of what was going on with Argentinian government, they were not going to accept the cup if they won. Their runners-up medals were sent to their hotel. That is from Jair in Kildare. Ernst Happel, who managed Feyenoord, Rotterdam and Hamburg to European Cups, was their manager, an Austrian manager. 1978, because this you were mentioning just before the break, because we ran out of time before the break, Dan. 1978 was the World Cup of long goals. I spent my childhood summers trying to recreate Arie Haan's 40-yard bullet for Holland against Italy. That is Rob in Dublin.
Do you not have that Orbis folder behind you in studio? It used to be there. It's like it was a World Cup 90.
I can't look now, but yeah, I think it is, yeah.
Yeah, and it was a World Cup 90 book. So I just mentioned this on Twitter last night that, like, obviously I wasn't born in 78, and you didn't have easy access to, like, you know, when you were growing up, you might hear about great goals, but it wasn't as if they were being repeated or you could get at them easily. So that 1990 book, it was like the Orbis album. So it was a part sticker album, part like a ring-binded sort of folder. And it included, like, drawings of great goals or sketches of great goals from history. So the Arie Haan goal was there. And I actually wonder, was it frame by frame? But it was actually just one photograph. So actually a guy posted it to me. He obviously had it and rooted it out. And it was just like illustrating how this 40-yard free kick again, almost like watching a golf drive take off from the tee now, the flight of the ball. And I remember for years looking at it, wondering, I'd love to see this goal. And eventually, you know, sort of a good 10, 15 years later, I think finally seeing it. But I think the Archie Gemmell goal actually was, someone reminded me that was in it too. You know, again, that was more of a frame.
I have it here.
Yeah. Do you have it, John? Yeah,
the thing is heavy. The thing is heavy, I'm telling you. But they've got the Archie Gemmell goal here. Yeah, I don't remember this, actually.
These were things of beauty. It sounds like you're really looking forward to the return of AstroTurf, Dan.
People who have it at the, I think actually on social media, then there was stickers within it, I think, and the Hans Krankel one, there was two guys who, like, 30 years later, it's like the two Milhouses meeting in The Simpsons. Like they both discovered that they had both missed this Krankel sticker. That was the one they couldn't get. Neither of them could get it. So anyone out there who has their old stickers, they could make these two punters out there very happy. They couldn't complete the full set because that was the missing piece. But that was the 78 World Cup for me growing up. It was the pictures of those goals, not actually having the footage to go with it until we could get at it easily years later.
But yeah, it's very good having here. Ari Hahn, Holland versus Italy, 1978. So your Twitter has come to reality. It's come to life, your tweet, Daniel. Shoot on sight was the style of the Dutch strikers of the 1970s. Ari Hahn did just that in the 1978 World Cup finals in Argentina. Lots of did you know, as you say, the room for the photo there, the picture. Ari Hahn, date of birth, November 1948, club Ajax, other clubs, number of caps, number of goals. The action replay, Kroll to Hahn. This is very good. I should have got this back in 1990. I was stuck on Panini and a thing called Winners, the Champions of Sport. Mm. It was a bit more, maybe it was for people older than me. I was only about 11 at the time, but it's excellent, this Orbis book.
Take it home with you, John.
Need more of them.
You take it home with you.
No, we have to keep the off-the-ball studio.
You'll never be seen in the studio again.
No. Yeah. It's too heavy for me to take home anyway. I've enough hair in my head at the moment. So just some great tweets here and text here on 53106 and at Off the Ball on Twitter. We're talking about the 1978 World Cup in Argentina, part of our World Cup Revisited series. We've really enjoyed your company over the last few weeks as we prepare for the return of the Premier League on June the 17th. Just some Bundesliga scores. We'll come to them in a moment when they do go full time. Former Drogheda and Athlone defender Larry Corbally had a son born on the day of the 1978 World Cup final. Kempes Corbally would have a brief stint with Shamrock Rovers between 1996 and 1998.
I remember the name. I didn't realize that was the origin of the name, though. Yeah,
I wonder was the horse named after him.
The William Mullins horse. He won the Punchestown Golf Cup, I think. Yeah,
probably was. Yeah.
Mauricio Pochettino's from Murphy in Santa Fe Province. Town is named after John James Murphy from Kilran, County Wexford, who did himself in Argentina in the late 19th century. Huge Irish influence in the country. That is from Tony Byrne in County Wexford. Love those kind of texts. People with the brilliant knowledge about history.
Well, did
and politics.
You see the Argentinian ambassador died recently a few weeks ago, and she was buried in Fox Rock in Mayo, which I think is a nod to Admiral William Brown, who would have, I think he set up the Argentine Navy, and he was a native of Mayo and has been commemorated in a famous ballad. And I have to thank Micheál Murphy for texting that in. But we do have links. Che Guevara was Che Guevara Lynch, wasn't he? He had an Irish background as well. And it's definitely a country I'd love to visit.
Yeah, the legacy, I think, of this World Cup, guys, is mass communication is so important. And it's just really, really sad what happened. And you have to think that it wouldn't happen now. Lads, there were 500 Dutch versus 80,000 Argentinians at the final. Bertoni, who got their third goal, says it was really another player for them. Dick Nanninga, who scored the Dutch goal, said the first thing he did after the final was go to the dressing room and roll a cigarette. He was back working in his flower shop 2 days later. That is from Jer. This is Off the Ball Saturday on News Talk. We're going to take a break. 53106, back after this.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, the greatest football partnership since Jeff and Heskey.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.